once I see that the device works properly, it release me.
I very much doubt it. You see, before you reactivated it, I reversed the polarity of the neutron flow.
You realize what will happen?
Oh, yes. You. Well, I've reversed the polarity of the neutron flow, so the TARDIS should be free of the force field now.
So he's reversed the polarity! Keep back!
Hello, and welcome to Reversing Polarity, a Doctor Who fancast about how we are gay and so is Doctor Who. My name is Rosie, my pronouns are they, them, and I am a self-confessed Whovian of many years standing.
My name is Aim, my pronouns are also they, them, and I am a writer and enthusiast and several other hats as well.
Excellent. Got it in one, again.
I'm very proud of you.
I'm so good at podcasting. All right. What are we doing this episode, Aim?
We are talking about The Curse of Peladon, which is very low gothic, I'd say.
Yeah.
Low gothic meets politics.
Yeah, it's interesting. This is our first repeat of a Doctor and Companion, isn't it? Exciting.
I think it is, yes. And so we're back with the Third Doctor and Joe.
Yay!
I love both of them very, very much.
Yes, they are wonderful. Such a dynamic duo as well. It's so cute.
I love their rapport, the way they bounce off each other. I could just watch it forever. Had you seen this one before?
I hadn't. My experience with the Third Doctor, my mum showed them to me, but I think she was always more into the unit stories.
Okay, so we had
Inferno and Claws of Axos and the Demons and all that kind of thing. I did really enjoy this one, though, so that was nice. Not that I was expecting not to, but I was surprised by how much I liked it.
I'd seen this one before earlier last year in our very haphazard rewatch of the classic series. And my housemate Joel is very, very into politics in general. So he was like, this one's about the EU. We love it. So that was my introduction.
And we do love the
EU. I enjoy
it.
Oh. Yes. We will return one day.
We will return one day. If I have anything to bloody say about it.
Which I imagine you do.
I imagine I do. I can get very frustrated and very loud when I need to be.
Good. That's what we need. Shall we dive headfirst into our recap?
Yes. So...
yeah, who's doing the synopsis today? Do you want to do it?
Sure, why not? We do normally vaguely remember whose turn it is, but it's been a week since we recorded, so...
Who knows if we even know how to podcast anymore.
Yeah, please let us know how well we podcast.
We're doubling the usual level of chaos into...
yeah.
Something we may not be able to handle.
So, the Doctor and Joe make a test flight in the TARDIS and arrive on the planet Peladon. Seeking shelter, they enter the citadel of the soon-to-be-crowned King Peladon, where the Doctor is mistaken for a human dignitary summoned to act as chairman of a committee assessing an application by the planet to join the Galactic Federation, the European Economic Commission, a.k.a.
All right, so in episode one, it is a rainy night on Peladon. The rain beats against the king's castle walls, perched high atop a mountain in a really lovely bit of set design. I think it's a model work, and it's very spooky.
Do you like my rain noises?
Oh, that! I thought you were just gasping for some reason.
I did.
Thank you. You're setting the scene beautifully.
With some year sixes last year, I did body percussion where we made all of them like click their fingers and stamp, and it sounded like a thunderstorm. And God, do I wish I had like 30 hands because I would be doing the most amazing Foley right now.
Well, we will meet a multi-handed alien in a
we
little
will!
Bit, and maybe they will be very good.
Yes, I hope so. Anyway, I'll stop making noises now.
Torbis, the King's Chancellor, enters the throne room to tell the King that the delegate from Alpha Centauri, who's just known as Alpha Centauri, has arrived, but they still await the delegate from Earth. Hepesh, the King's High Priest and Torbis's brother, is unsure that the delegation should even take place, whereas Torbis is very much in support.
Is he Torbis's brother?
They are all very fashionable.
I really had not caught on that he was Torbis's brother.
No, I hadn't either.
I thought that they
I
were
guess
like...
you can sort of see it.
I thought they were supposed to be like brothers. Maybe that's just me desperately grasping at any male relationships.
I also want to highlight there, I think it is purple satin and velvet short shorts with thigh-high socks.
My God, it is so good.
And they all have like white hair with a ginger streak right through the middle of it.
It's fucking incredible. I can't.
Certainly a look. Hepesh talks about the curse of Agador. The king stops the two from arguing, and Torbis reminds the king that he has raised him since his father died and wouldn't put him wrong. Hepesh tries to interject, but the king says that he agrees with Torbis and that Peladon should join the Galactic Federation. Hepesh gives in. Torbis heads off to tell the other delegates of the arrival of Alpha Centauri.
Yay!
Alpha Centauri.
Alpha Centauri.
Enjoy editing that.
I will. Thank you very much. Perhaps I'll edit it by not editing it. The verisimilitude of it, you know.
Yep. Yeah, I like
Cinema verite.
As he heads off, a gigantic beast roars and he is knocked to the floor. Brilliant Foley.
Thank you.
Gaz from the throne room rushes to his aid. The monster returns and they hide. By the time the king arrives, Torbis is dead. The king asks the guard who did this, and he points to a statue on the wall. Hepesh said it is the spirit of Agador, the ancient curse of Peladon.
Yeah, it's Grun he asks, isn't it?
I think Grun, so, yeah. Grun being the only named guard.
Oh, jinx!
Oh, dear. The TARDIS lands on the edge of the mountain. Inside, the Doctor congratulates himself on a perfect landing of the first test flight after he's got the TARDIS working. Bit premature, Doctor.
Oh, I love him.
Jo is complaining, as he'd promised to get her back in time for a night out with Mike Yates.
I love this so much. It's like...
Jo can do better.
She can. Mike Yates is gay. We have to accept that at this point, right?
It's true. Yep. I think there's also a line got cut where the Doctor's like, it's also a time machine, Jo. You'll be fine.
Yeah, and it's not a number 88 bus either.
Before the Doctor allows Jo to leave, he says he will check the scanner, but it doesn't work. Jo asks if he is sure they're back at base, and the Doctor says that the atmosphere, temperature and gravity are all correct.
But not the Leaving location.
But who needs to check that if everything else is fine?
Yeah, he doesn't have an atlas on the TARDIS. GPS.
Leaving the TARDIS, they discover that they're on the edge of a cliff. The TARDIS falls off the ledge and plummets down the mountain.
Yep.
The Doctor... another...
Their
constant
shot.
Ploy of keeping the TARDIS away from the Doctor so he can't just leave or...
Yeah, it does seem very black and white, Doctor Who, the premise that the Doctor wouldn't stay simply to fix things, but I still love it.
The Doctor reassures Jo that the TARDIS is indestructible. It's just a question of how to get to it. They can't climb down the mountain, so they decide to climb up it instead.
Yeah, this is the genesis of a point I attempted to make to AIM off podcast, but could not figure out the wording. But I really miss when the TARDIS was like a physical object that things could happen to. Because it feels like in the modern series, like bad stuff doesn't... Like the TARDIS doesn't really get into her own scrapes unless it's like supernatural issues. Whereas back in the old series, constantly falling off things, getting stuck... Like, I just miss when it was a spaceship in itself rather than, like, a big room that moves around. I don't know how to explain it.
I'm trying to think of a time if that does happen in New Who and nothing's jumping to mind, yeah. But doesn't mean it's not there.
Please let us know if I am mistaken and it has, in fact, fallen off a cliff recently. I just think it's fun.
It does get, like, missing posters and graffiti spray-painted onto it in season one of New Who.
Yeah, that's
But that's
true.
Not the same at all.
Yeah. It's, you know, that is still... I do like treating it as an object in an environment, you know? Like it is affected by things that happen. Like, the bit where it gets an arrow stuck in the door, that's good.
Doesn't it explode at one point and they find exploded TARDIS bits all over the place?
Yes, because it gets... It goes into the middle of a sun. It's a very good finale, actually. Don't at me.
I haven't rewatched those since they aired. Maybe I should.
Yeah. I don't know. I really like Series 5, but, you know, I haven't watched it in a couple of years.
Yeah. I remember finding it quite polarising.
I just love Rory.
Rory is the best and deserves the world.
Yeah. I got very annoyed last week because I was doing a U quiz and it claimed that Rory wasn't a companion. And I was like, what are you talking about? He's a companion for two series.
He's a companion and he's very good.
He is very good. I had a Rory RP blog on Tumblr in 2012.
Of course you did.
Yeah.
I think looking back, I just wanted them to be a polycule. And
oh, of course. Never quite got that. I ended up dating the person I RP'd Eleven and Rory with.
Amazing. Alpha Centauri, an alien creature with one big eye and many arms, presents themselves to the king,
yes,
wishful of a happy alliance.
Yes.
The king informs them that they are just waiting on the delegate from Earth. Hepesh mentions to put Torbis's death to the king, and this spooks Alpha Centauri.
Everything spooks
back
Alpha
on the
Centauri. I relate so hard to how incredibly nervous they are. They are like, oh no, someone's been murdered! Like,
with that exact voice. It
yeah.
is pitchy.
Yeah.
And yet, I love them.
Alpha Centauri, our first canonical non-binary alien that we've encountered, besides the Doctor,
absolutely,
of course.
I would die for Alpha Centauri.
Yes, and we'll get onto that in our gender segment. Part 2.0, we'd get to do it again. just to talk about the representation of it. But, you know, I think it's fun to have that in a 1970s episode of Doctor Who, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, if anything, would have loved more of it.
Definitely.
But they're great. Back on the cliffside, the Doctor and Joe are struggling to scale the rock face until Joe finds a tunnel which they clamber into. Hepesh shows Alpha Centauri into the delegation room, where they're met by the delegate from Arcturus, a small green head in a dome attached to a computer. Alpha Centauri tells the Arcturian counterpart of the death of Torbis, which causes him to react with great concern. Boy, there's some grammatical structures happening here.
Yeah, yeah. We do. They refer to Arcturus and Alpha Centauri exclusively as where they are delegates from, which I guess is like a political structure thing.
Yeah.
I kind of wish that meant that they would refer to the Ice Warriors as Mars. I think that would be very fun. But alas, they do not. Also, the creature design is excellent.
Honestly, like, quite something.
Like, I mean, we'll get onto it behind the scenes. I assume you have that quote from the guy who was being forced to wear... Yeah, it's a good one. It's a very good quote. and then Arcturus being a little grain head in a dome. Genuinely pretty good, you know? Like, it looks like a real... It did make me think about that episode of Star Trek where Pike is in that, like, black wheelchair
the box thing.
Yeah.
It made me think of the floating head, their heads in the dome from Futurama.
There you go. Or, similarly, in Futurama, when they're in that wheelchair thing with the blinking light. It all links!
It's almost like sci-fi has tropes.
It's almost like that.
Alpha Centauri is scared, but their Arcturian colleague is more angry. He blows up a jar,
yes,
casual, and tells Hepesh that a similar fate befalls anyone who threatens the delegation. In the tunnel system, the Doctor and Joe come across a shrine. The Doctor says he's not seen anything like it before on Earth.
I really like the shrine, but then also, I didn't realise this, but my BritBox had to buffer, so it just froze on the shot of it for ages. I was like, that's a really effective piece of direction, but no, it was just it was
it's
buffering.
Just the internet.
but it is very cool, and we get to see Agador's... image.
There's a lot of good set design in this, I think. Hepesh and the king talk about the times of old and Torbis. It is revealed that the king is half Peladonian and half human, and Hepesh seems scathing of Earth. Hepesh believes that Torbis was killed by Agador. The king seems confused as to why he wasn't killed if Agador rose due to the threat of joining the Galactic Federation.
An excellent point. Well done, Peladon.
Hepesh says it's a sign. He considers the delegates to be forming a trap because they despise Peladon and think of its people as distrustful savages. The king asks Hepesh to summon the delegates to prove them otherwise. The Doctor and Joe find themselves with a number of different tunnels to go down. They hear a roar and decide to go another way.
Of course.
Which is spent sensible, it's what I do.
Yeah, they like look at each other and they're like,
not that one.
Yeah, probably best not.
So the way they do go down is blocked, but the Doctor's attention is drawn towards a torch. If it's an abandoned tunnel system, why is the torch still alight? He pulls it and a door swings open, which I love.
Yes.
Going through, they find themselves in the castle. They hear something coming and hide. An ice warrior shuffles past.
Yes! I love the ice warriors so much.
The ice warriors are great in this story.
They're
as
just,
well.
The thing is that I love them all the time. Just love the Ice Warriors. I don't know why. Their little Lego
hands. Oh, that's going to be my next question.
Their little Lego hands and the voices where they go, and the fact that they're from Mars and like the entire
and just how green they
entire
are
aesthetic, the fact that they weren't in the show for ages and then they finally returned in like a Cold War submarine story that I barely remember, the fact that apparently they can get out of the they can get out of the hard shells, which I think is very fun.
Oh my god, apparently they also most of the like main cast in the second Doctor Zero are quite short. So the Ice Warriors looked even taller, and then when returning, they had to do some camera magic to make them still seem really tall.
It does not surprise me that most of them were short. When you consider Wendy Padbury and Patrick Troughton, and then Fraser Hines is probably the tallest, and he's not very tall.
Even then, he's a small lad.
He was a small lad. So there we go. But yeah, I just adore them. I'm really looking forward to Seeds of Death, because then we get to see the Rhinestone Ice Warrior.
My god, I don't think I've seen Seeds of Death yet.
I'm very fond of it.
So once the Ice Warrior's gone, the Doctor tells Joe of the danger of the Ice Warriors and they decide to head back into the tunnel, but they are soon surrounded by castle guards. The King tells the delegates of Torbus's death, mentioning the curse but trying to brush it away. he just died, don't worry, yeah, does anybody want ice cream?
It's an internal problem.
The Ice Warrior delegate wishes to hear of the curse.
Isla. Love Isla. Isla and Sorg. They're just great.
Why do I feel like they're your favourites?
I just love Ice Warriors and I love them. So in combination.
They are very good Ice Warriors. Hepesh tells of the Beast of Peladon, an extinct creature that used to be hunted as a rite of passage. Legend has it that the creature would rise again when a stranger would appear that would bring great peril to Peladon. This story is interrupted by the entrance of the Doctor.
Woo!
The Ice Warrior approaches the Doctor menacingly, but then assumes that he's the delegate from Earth, and the Doctor goes along with this. When accused of being late, the Doctor explains that his spaceship crashed and inquires if there's any way of getting it back. Hepesh says he'll arrange something and then asks for the Doctor's credentials, but the Doctor says they're lost in the
crash. I love how nervous he seems at this point. Like, he is lying, but he seems very like, oh, I'm very sorry about all of this.
Yeah.
It's quite sweet.
It sounds very plausible as well.
Yeah, it does sound very plausible. Congrats on coming up with that with 5 seconds notice, Doctor.
It makes me wonder if that has actually happened to him before.
Potentially.
The King is not interested in credentials, but seems very taken with Joe. Hepesh asks whether Joe is of royal blood. Only royalty or delegates from planets are allowed in the throne room on punishment by death.
God.
Great.
Everything's punishable by death on this fucking planet.
Yeah. No wonder they don't have a great rep. Joe takes on the role of a member of the royal family, and the Doctor plays along, introducing her as Princess Josephine of TARDIS.
She is instantly into it. Like, the fucking... Yes. Hepesh asks whether she's of royal blood, and she's like, we do not speak through intermediaries. It's so good! And she's got her hair curled, and she's wearing this beautiful, like, overdress. It's incredible.
It's both really fun and also really good.
Yeah. It's just...
I like it.
Oh, we love Joe. We love Joe.
Yes! Outside the throne room, a guard climbs above the door.
The Ice Warrior asks...
Just having a bit of exercise,
yeah.
I guess.
Nothing suspicious.
The Ice Warrior asks what powers Joe has on the Committee of Assessment, and the Doctor says she's just a royal observer. The delegate from Alpha Centauri tells the Doctor of Torbus's death. As the delegates argue, the guard is creating a lever underneath a large statue outside the throne room.
Yeah, creating a lever.
The Doctor orders...
You need your big plank of wood, and then you've got a lever.
And here's one I made earlier.
Yeah.
I have very little lever experience.
That's fair. You need your fulcrum, you need your meter long ruler, because I didn't have any other long pieces of wood, and you need your foot, and that's all you need to make a lever.
Well, if it was that easy, I can understand how the guard's having such a good time
with
it. The Doctor orders the squabbling to cease, and Hepesh agrees. They decide to all go to the delegation room. As they leave, the King flirts with Joe. I would too.
Yeah.
Filing down the corridor, the Doctor sees the statue falling and headed directly for Alpha Centauri. Oh no!
What a good first episode for this serial. Like, so much happens.
There's so much setup as well, and it's all done. It doesn't drag.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And we should mention the King is played by David Troughton, Patrick Troughton's son. So we have a connection within Doctor Who.
Yeah, I think it's his third role in the show or something.
Yeah, my favourite thing I learned when I was listening to the Three Doctors commentary is that they had, he and Katie Manning had mutual crushes but never did anything about it.
I know. Oh. According to TARDIS Wiki, they started dating during this serial, but every other thing I can find about it says that never really happened.
Looks like TARDIS Wiki is just wrong. I was going to try and make a pun, but I could not figure it out. TARDIS isn't. Sorry.
TARDIS Ronki?
I'm going to start calling it the TARDIS Y key if it keeps making these mistakes, you know?
It just, that's this real person ship.
Yes.
So
we have to be, we don't have to respect that actually. Right.
No, we don't.
Episode 2, the Doctor leaps forward and pushes the delegate from Alpha Centauri out the way. Good. I love
saving
Alpha Centauri.
The friend.
Alpha Centauri, for the record, is a big eye with six arms and a long body.
So like, imagine Mike from Monsters, Inc. if he was stretchy.
Yes, that's exactly it. I just, you know, it's just wonderful. Inside the throne room, Hepesh stops the king from going to help because Hepesh sucks. God.
The worst.
The guard sneaks off in the confusion.
Is this the bit where I point out the guard's outfit as well?
Oh, is he? Is this where he's wearing the one that's like got three boob cutouts?
It is... what I would imagine gladiator porno costumes to be.
Probably. We didn't research that. I'm really sorry to everyone who trusts us to be really rigorous in our research, but we didn't research gladiator porn for this.
Forgive
one.
Me for not Googling gladiator porn.
Yes. I mean...
not today.
I forgive you. I also wouldn't want to.
Thank you.
Alpha Centauri is very concerned about the accident, but the chief ice warrior, Islia, thanks the Doctor. Hepesh says it was Agador that saved them, which is hysterical because it's a big statue of Agador that fell.
And I imagine people saw the Doctor do it.
Yeah, he's like, the Agador spirit moved him. And it's like, no. The Doctor says the incident needs to be investigated, but Hepesh disagrees. Alpha Centauri is very upset that their lives are being put at risk. Some more squealing from Alpha Centauri. I love the extent to which Alpha Centauri does just whine for the whole serial, and I really admire it. Like, I wish I could complain with this much consistency.
And conviction as well.
Yeah. They know what is up. And what is up is that they are not being respected. Islia asks for more information about Agador, one assumes. Hepesh says that it is foretold that when Agador returns, he will bring terror and darkness, and death will walk with him. Islia says...
Sounds badass as hell.
Yeah. Islia says that if Hepesh speaks for the king, then there is no point in holding the delegation. The delegate from Arcturus agrees. The king enters and refuses to cancel the delegation and brings all the delegates back into the throne room. The king is called Peladon, which is very confusing, and I didn't realise for quite a long time.
Yeah,
but his name was Peladon. He's not King of Peladon. His name is King Peladon.
He's just Peladon. Yep. Even though he's also on Peladon.
Yeah. The king says that all the delegates come from areas that used to be racked with war, and he wants Peladon to follow in their path. Jo sneaks off while the delegates talk, because she wants to investigate, because she's a detective.
She's,
I love her.
Very Nancy Drew.
Yeah. The doctor says that the delegates have a simple choice, side with the king or with Agador. Woo! Jo is snuck up to the balcony where the statue was. She finds footprints and an item on the floor. As far as I remember, they're quite big footprints. But other than that, they're not very specific. In the novelization, we made it 25 minutes into the episode before I mentioned the novelization. That might be a record. It's specifically mentioned as being like an ice warrior sized footprint. Like, it looks like Sorg's foot. Sorg is the I was about to say the handmaiden to Islay's feudal lord.
that's the dynamic going on.
It is kind of the dynamic going on. It's very fealty stuff. But yeah, so she's off doing her girl detective stuff. The delegate from Arcturus makes the Doctor chair of the delegates and says he must decide. The Doctor was already chair because Earth was always going to be chairman, I think. That was my understanding, because as soon as he arrives, they're like, aha, it's the chairman. And the Doctor is like, well, I suppose I'll go into this leadership role if I have to.
Also very much like media made on Earth to put Earth at the centre of this delegation.
Yeah. But, you know, someone has to chair it. Presumably they rotate.
That's true.
They did rock, paper, scissors. And then every single time the Ice Warriors lose because they can't move their hands. Sorry, everyone. I can't get over the Lego hands. It's perfect design. How did they build things with no thumbs?
They're basically spanners on their hands.
That's true.
They don't need tools.
I adore them. Although, to be fair, with the new canon that they can get out of the shell, maybe it's that they have fingers, but they're, like, in the Lego gloves.
Maybe they have, like, three hands within the gloves.
Oh, God. There's a lot going on there. I barely remember what the naked Ice Warrior looked like in that episode, because I haven't watched it since it came out in, like, 2014 or whenever it was, but...
I'm not going to Google naked Ice Warrior, and I've thought better of it.
It's probably going to end up with some, like, Homestuck shit, so probably a good choice.
True.
The Doctor says the delegation should continue. Islay says this puts them all at risk. True. The King tries to persuade him that this isn't the case, which, you know, like, King Peladon doesn't know any better. He doesn't know what's occurring, basically.
But also all evidence does not agree.
Yeah. Alpha Centauri is worried that they may be kept there by force. Islay gets angry at the thought of this, and tempers start to fray whilst Joy sneaks back in. Joy? Whilst Joe sneaks back in. Can't read. The King begs the delegates to stay and help his people. The delegates say they will adjourn and reach a decision. I love how much politics there is in this. Just like, well, we can't make a decision until we've all talked about it. And, like, obviously that's how it works, but I find it very funny to imagine a six-year-old watching Doctor Who at this point and being like, why won't they stop talking about it? Like, I love it as someone with a politics aleful, but...
Yeah, very good point.
Yeah.
I think this is one of the highest rated, in terms of viewing numbers, since 1965 when it aired. And
funny.
A lot of that was credited with... adults liked watching the politics. So
definitely
it got people
it
in.
To watching about... Hang on. Oh, God. I'm trying to think about what was going on. We'll get to this in the behind-the-scenes thing, so I'll just cut this. But I'm trying to think about what was going on with the actual European Economic Commission, because I know eventually they got in and Thatcher set the pound too high and nearly crashed the economy.
Sounds about right. This was when they were just about to... be accepted before they'd call the referendum to ratify.
Right. Good to know. Okay. All the delegates leave, but the King asks Joe to stay and dismisses Hepesh. When alone, the King asks Joe if she believes him on a personal level. Joe doesn't answer. The King says that he's lonely. Oh my God.
I mean, it's not a great move, but also in the year of our Lord 2021, same.
Yeah, oh my God. It's like I was in Lidl and I saw all these other people around me and I was like, oh, this is so weird.
We've had a rat problem lately, and whenever, like, the pest control people visit, I'm like, let's just talk.
How is Minky?
I'm so alone. Haven't heard anything of Minky for a long time, which, quite sad, I miss them.
Yeah, you miss all the Minkies.
I'm so lonely. I want my rats back.
He tells Joe that they have a bond and says she is beautiful. Telling her she has a bond is a very accurate representation of what happens. He's like, my mother was from Earth, and in the novelization, it's specifically that Joe looks almost exactly like his mother, which is a hysterically Oedipal thing to put in your Doctor Who novelization.
It's like, why is that such a trope though? Like, mother doppelgangers.
I genuinely think it's Oedipus, you know? They're like,
that'll do it.
Where was I? He asks again if she believes him. She says she does. He asks her to speak for him at the commission. Joe becomes cross, saying that he wasn't looking for a friend but a political ally. Excellent Joe bit. Like, it's just good.
Like, she just calls him out on his shit.
Yeah, like, she understands what's going on. She's got it, and she's mad at him for manipulating her. And I'm like, hell yes, Joe. And she says that she's going to remain neutral. Hepesh and the mute guard Grun are worshipping at a shrine. Hepesh tells Grun it was not his fault that he failed to deal with the delegates, but says that they need to destroy the King's enemies, starting with the Doctor. Exciting stuff.
Oh no, peril.
I think the chapter of this in the book is called Death to the Doctor! Exclamation mark, and it's very exciting. The novelization also features some incredible illustrations, which I will put on the Twitter. So follow us on Twitter.
Yeah, what is beautiful.
There's some great ones, including of the fight later on. Right. The Doctor examines what Joe found on the balcony. It is an electronic key made of trisilicate used for operating Ice Warrior spaceships. I don't remember it being about operating an Ice Warrior spaceship specifically, but he does say that trisilicate is only found on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
Which, while it may be accurate, I don't know that that prohibits other planets from using it.
Having it?
Considering that we're talking about a galactic, presumably, trade federation.
Yeah, it's almost like the Doctor has some prejudices here.
Some, you know, perhaps historically valid prejudices, but, you know, it's being disproven in this serial. The Doctor says the footprints must have been that of Islia. Jo says she thought Islia was in the throne room with them the whole time, but the Doctor said he could have slipped away like she did. The Doctor says that the last time he encountered the Ice Warriors, they were trying to colonise Earth, and Peladon is a very Earth-like planet. Yeah, pretty much.
I can see it.
He also says that the Ice Warriors are very savage, warlike, and strong enough to topple a statue. Jo is unsure. The Doctor points out that it could hardly have been the other two delegates and starts to wonder what their motive might be. Now, this is where we find out that Alpha Centauri is... What does the Doctor say? Something terrible.
It's not a him, it's an it. A hermaphrodite hexapod.
A hermaphroditic hexapod, yeah. Because Jo's like, or is he a she? And, you know, I mean, he's not, like, Jo, he's not, like, mean about it. Clearly, Alpha Centauri uses its pronouns, but it's not a great look for a character to use those.
Yeah, especially if that's your only representation.
Yeah.
Then again, it was the 70s. I don't actually know what the state of non-he-she pronouns were in the 70s.
Yeah, or indeed the state of understanding what intersex conditions are.
Especially outside of queer circles.
Definitely. But there we go. In the novelization, they don't have this scene because from the beginning they're referring to Alpha Centauri with a mixture of he, they, and it pronouns, which are completely inconsistent. But, you know...
Also valid.
Non-binary... I was going to say king. Non-binary hero, Alpha Centauri.
Non-binalty.
Yeah. Returned in the new series. Haven't seen the episode yet, but, you know, they come back.
Nice.
In Empress of Mars, I think.
I must have seen this. Anyway.
It's a new one with Ice Warriors in it. They are interrupted by the sound of an alarm. Very, you know, ooh. The alarm is attached to the delegate from Arcturus, who is in a state of distress. The Doctor examines him and sees that his life support system has been removed. The Doctor says it is a small box with a number of circuits in it, and Jo begins to look for it. She asks the Doctor if she can search the delegate's room, as whoever has it will incriminate themselves, and the Doctor says no, as it's too dangerous.
I mean, there have been several murder attempts already.
Yeah.
He's got a valid point.
Yeah, he's very patronising to Jo at several points in this serial, and she's like, well, screw you, and goes and does it anyway, pretty much every time.
Yeah, which is very good.
We support her. As the Doctor tries to rectify the situation, aka save Arcturus from potentially dying, the other delegates enter and think he is hurting the delegate. The Doctor manages to rectify the situation, and Hepesh says this must have been done by Agador, because obviously Agador knows how technology works and wouldn't just have... Yeah, the Doctor says Agador would not have had the technical skills to do this, and I think he says specifically that he would have just smashed the glass dome, which is like, you know,
That would also do a murder.
Yeah, and while looking at Islia says whoever did it must come from a technologically advanced race. He's so unsubtle.
It's almost like he has no time for...
Yeah, he's like, I'm not gonna stop myself from accusing anybody because I'm convinced that I'm right. It's a very doctory thing to do, I think. Islia rejects the accusation and says that both Alpha Centauri and Earth have the technological capabilities to do it, and suggests that they found the Doctor with him, implying that the Doctor may have deliberately removed the life support thing and then put it back in to remove himself from suspicion, which is some very good logical thinking from Islia.
Yep, and if I'd just been accused of a potential murder, that's probably where I would go as well. It's like a game of werewolf.
Yeah, oh man. That would be... If there was a Doctor Who-themed version of werewolf, that would be very good. I once played a Sherlock-themed edition of werewolf way back in 2011.
Back in the day.
Yeah, back in the day, I was at a sleepover, and I... I just remember specifically being accused of, like, having a web of lies. But yeah, Jo sneaks into the Ice Warrior's room and searches for the delegate for Arcturus' life support system. She finds it in a crate. Now, you know what else she finds in the Ice Warrior's room?
Is it that there was only one bed?
There was only one bed!
My favourite of all the tropes.
It's such a good trope. We'll get into this in the gay segment, but I just think it's very indicative of some of the dynamics that are going on. She finds it in a crate, but hears someone coming and hides behind a curtain. Extremely funny hiding place. Like, I know it's the only place to hide, but like... I don't know why, but Sorg is Liz's counterpart, enters and sees Joe's feet under the curtain. Incredible moment of comedy. Like, he pulls it back and asks what she's doing. Joe says she was looking for the life support and found it. Sorg says that it's not theirs. Sorg goes to show Islia and locks Joe in the room. And Sorg is basically like, well, obviously she was about to plant it in our room to accuse us.
Yeah.
Which is, again, very good piece of logical reasoning. Well done, Sorg.
Mm-hmm. Can't blame it.
They're kind of accidentally framing themselves at this point. but there we are. The delegate for Arcturus says he was attacked, but his memory circuits have been affected and he can't remember by who. The doctor tells Islia that that is very lucky for him and leaves the room. He encounters Gron in the corridor, who urgently forces him away. This is watched by Hepesh. I don't know when the doctor learned Grun's name, but he does address him by name at this point. You know?
Maybe he overheard it.
Yeah, he respects the working classes is what I'm saying. The delegates discuss what happened to the delegate from Arcturus. Islia says he suspects it was the Doctor. Alpha Centauri asks what motive he would have. Islia says he may be trying to form an alliance between Joe and the King to create a strong Earth-Peladonian link which will dominate the Galactic Federation. So much politics!
I mean, that's also really fair reasoning. That's a strong motive.
Definitely. The delegate from Arcturus says that this cannot be allowed. Sorg enters and asks to see Islia. The other two delegates discuss their worries. Islia returns and tells the delegates that Joe was found with the life support. Joe is waiting for the return of the Ice Warriors. She notices a high window and pulls a table and box over and escapes out the window! Ugh. It's so good.
Iconic. Just an absolute icon.
Yeah. Honestly, despite wearing a really long skirt, it's quite a practical outfit. She can do anything.
I don't know. Those shoes...
Yeah, I mean, she could take off the shoes to be extra practical. Yeah. But, you know, she was climbing a rock face. She was finding tunnels. Yep. And she still looks very
clean. She's got a lot of agency in this episode as well, which we love to see.
She's great. And she gets lots of scenes with Peladon or with other characters, separate from the Doctor. She skirts along the ledge with rocks falling underneath her feet and re-enters through the next window and finds herself in a corridor. Gron gestures that the Doctor should enter a door. The Doctor asks if someone is in trouble. Gron... I mean, it says yes. I don't think TARDIS Wiki has remembered that Grun can't talk.
Cannot say yes.
He is mute. But yeah, Grun indicates that this is the case and the Doctor rushes in. Joe is lost in the corridors. She sees a terrifying monster and runs away. I think that this monster is very cute, actually.
I adore this monster.
Very fluffy. Very sweet.
Looks like we'll just have a nap.
Yeah.
Yeah, just wants to roar and find some snack. Same.
Exactly. The Doctor and Gron are in the cave system. They hear a roar. Gron gets scared and runs off. The Doctor goes after him, but turns back to find out what danger there might be in the tunnel, because he can't resist danger. Joe runs into Islia. She is terrified of Agador. Basically, like, she runs into him and he's like, why did you leave the room? And Joe kind of goes, there's a monster over there! And Islia's like, Sorg, go and check. Sorry, I can't stop doing the Ice Warrior voice.
Please don't. Please do the entire podcast.
I think my voice box would eject itself from my throat if I tried to do it for the whole episode. But maybe it'll return once in a while. Sorg goes to look and finds nothing. Islia says this is all part of the trick. Joe says she's got to find the Doctor. So Islia and Sorg are very suspicious, rightfully.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they've been accused of murder.
Yeah, Joe is led back to the Ice Warrior's room. Islia asks why she escaped, and she says that she was frightened. Reasonably.
Yeah.
Islia asks if she really saw Agador, and she says she did. Islia still thinks it's a trick. Joe says that the Doctor told her that their species are warriors. Islia says that they used to be, but now they reject violence. And then Joe asks why they have a gun if they reject violence. Again, very good question. <Also fair. laughs> Yeah, Islia says that in order to sue for peace, she must survive. And then Joe apologises for assuming things about Ice Warriors, and it's good. She's like, we may have misjudged you. The Doctor is rushing through the cave system with Agador in pursuit. He reaches a dead end, but sees a torch again and pulls it. He emerges into the shrine room. Hepesh finds him and orders Grun to seize him. He says the Doctor is impure and should not desecrate the shrine. Hepesh has brought the Doctor to the King. He is facing charges of desecrating the Temple of Agador. The King is apologetic, but says the laws of Peladon state that the sentence for his crime is death.
Who could have seen that coming?
Yeah, it's a very everything is deserves death. It's very draconian, literally draconian in it this is. Case.
This is where TARDIS Wiki suddenly gives us much more concise episode summaries. So now you've heard every detail of the first two episodes.
Yep, including our additional details of what Ice Warriors sound like.
We'll move on to episode 3. The Doctor tries to explain that he was trying to escape the tunnels and stumbled into the temple, but Peladon is unaware of the tunnel's existence. Joe urges the King to be flexible, given the Doctor's diplomatic status, and he agrees to a compromise. Trial by combat, yeah, against Gran in the ceremonial pit. Joe argues with Peladon over his clinging to ridiculous superstition, but is surprised when he proposes to her and asks her to help him change his planet for the better. Quite a lot happens in that.
Yeah, it's a very, very short episode summary, and I'm looking at it. It's like 3 paragraphs, and they're like, hey, I actually really like Joe talking to Peladon.
Yeah.
Peladon is like very distinctly separating his kingship from his what personal feelings, and Joe is like, you can't combine them, I don't understand you. Like, he has clearly been raised to view the law and his own life as extremely separate enforcements, I guess. It's an interesting conflict to have between characters. It's quite developed, I think.
Yeah, as it also has a nice little bit of contrast with the tensions of the delegation as well.
Yeah. When they're like, because the delegation are like, can you not, maybe not kill the delegate from Earth? Because then we probably would have to, like, start a war. And then someone brings up the fact that that would contravene the Federation Constitution, and Alpha Centauri starts referencing it. It's like,
The icon they are.
It's great.
Hepesh offers to help the Doctor escape before the combat, drawing him a map. Is this the first nice thing Hepesh has ever done? Maybe.
My thing is that, you know, why? Why is he doing it? It's so suspicious.
He explains he's afraid of the progress Federation membership may bring, and then admits he has a powerful ally assisting him.
Very.
For their part, the delegates must obey Federation law and not interfere with local customs. However, Islia tells Joe that since the Doctor saved him from the statue, he must do everything in his power to repay the debt.
Yeah, I do. This does make me think, like, is there, like, a Galactic Federation, like, human rights charter that they would immediately have to sign on to?
Yes, I would hope so.
I would hope so. It's just, it does remind me of the ECHR.
I wonder why.
I wonder why there's a parallel between...
No idea.
Between this and that. Presumably there's no, like, Geneva Conventions of Peladon where they're like, hey, maybe we shouldn't have trial by combat.
Hey, trial by combat's a nice option. The other one is just certain death.
Yeah, to be fair, they don't have trial by ordeal. That would be worse. Google that if you want to get really mad about historical misogyny.
Not today.
Not today.
Arcturus listens to this conversation with a bug. The Doctor does escape into the tunnels.
Woo!
He finds Agador and uses a spinning mirror and a Venusian lullaby to hypnotise him,
yes.
Which is sung to the tune of God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen.
Would you like to hear it sung to the tune of God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen?
Are you going to serenade me?
I absolutely will serenade you if you want.
Please do.
Clock laid a partha man in clutch, Harun, Harun, Harun. Clock laid a sheen a tira nudge, Harun, Harun, Harun.
It is very soothing, thank you.
Yeah. And like you said, did you get this from the novelization or did you transcribe it lovingly? Neither. Because it's not from the it's not in the novelization. They just say that he sang a lovely song. But there you go. It's sung to the tune of God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen, as Aim said, which I didn't notice at first, because obviously my brain is so hardwired to the words for that song. It would be quite funny if he did just sing God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen and that hypnotized everybody.
I also really like how John Pertwee stresses different symbols, almost like he's singing with a Welsh accent and stressing things in a slightly non-anglophonic way.
It's good. I really like obviously they do it in the new series as well, but I really like when the classic series decides to bring in elements of alien culture. Because, you know, because I don't know, obviously in the new series they definitely hammer on the translation circuit as a thing. So would they just have heard it as the as in English rather than having a beautiful, weird, mysterious language? I don't know.
I wonder if it's something that the Doctor being so closely linked to the target just turn that off and be like, well, this sounds nice. You're going to appreciate the way this sounds.
Yeah, he's thinking about it phonetically so it doesn't translate to his.
Just as this lullaby seems to be working, Jo arrives and frightens the beast away.
On purpose, because she thinks it's about to attack the doctor. She gets, like, a torch and goes, I'll get it! and then the doctor calls her an idiot, and it made me sad, even though, like, I get why he's annoyed.
Yep, Jo deserves better, as always.
She usually gets somewhat better than that, but, you know.
The doctor goes back and tries to explain to everyone that Agatha is animal-trained to attack anything living beneath the Citadel. But Hepesh insists that he'll be taken to the combat pit.
Yeah, Hepesh is very, very insistent about this because obviously he wants the doctor dead.
There he faces Grun with halberds and swords in hand-to-hand combat.
Incredible.
It's also got absolutely no backing music, the fight, which struck me as a bit odd.
Also, in the novelization, it's like an incredibly, like, it's like a 10-page long fight. It goes on for so long, there's like... You know, Venusian Aikido moves, and, like, it's all in this... It's in an outdoor arena that has, like, traps and stuff built into the thing, instead of, like, a sand pit.
I thought you were joking when you said that it went through it frame by frame.
It's so long, and I was reading it through, and I was like, honest to God, like, it's good. Like, it was one of the best parts of the novelization. It was so weird reading the whole thing, and seeing the illustrations of stuff that didn't happen on the show. it's a great fight. It's very Star Trek-y in its own way.
Yeah, especially in the direction of it, I think.
Yeah, here's a fun fact. The person who is inside the Alpha Centauri suit was the stunt coordinator.
Oh, nice!
I'm fairly certain anyway. That's my understanding of the situation.
Nice.
Imagining him keeping the costume on while he directs it.
Trying to do the voice as well. After a long struggle, the Doctor is victorious but refuses to kill Grun because the Doctor doesn't enjoy killing.
He certainly doesn't.
Watching from the edge of a pit, Arcturus and Sorg draw their weapons and fire.
Because Sorg sees Arcturus draw his weapon and, like, you know, also draws his weapon. This is a great cliffhanger as well. It's like, I think it's all pretty good cliffhangers in this episode. In this serial. Like, it's quite well structured. So, like, episode one, you introduce the threat. Episode two, you expand on the threat. Episode three, the Doctor gets in a really big fight. I do like the bit when he's holding the halberd. And Grun is just advancing on him and cutting the halberd shorter and shorter over time. It's great comedy. It's
very fun to watch.
And it was quite hard to tell when it was a stunt double and when it wasn't.
Which is not always the case in Doctor Who.
Yeah.
I guess because John Pertwee also liked to do his own stunts as far as possible.
He did do a lot of his own stunts. I reckon the stuff where he was being, like, thrown places probably was a stunt double. But, you know.
Well, hopefully.
Hopefully. So, episode four, last episode of the serial. It's another great four-parter. Nice and standard structure. Sorg is quicker on the trigger and kills Arcturus, who is trying to shoot the Doctor with his, like... vase exploding beam.
Yep.
It's great. It's a great effect. It's just big circles getting bigger and they're like red, so it's like, ooh, heat. You know, it conveys it quite well. I was impressed.
It does.
Hepesh flees and the others deduce he was in league with Arcturus and sabotage the life support with his directions. Because earlier, the reason that Isla and Sorg realised that Jo didn't sabotage Arcturus is that she thought that the little box was the life support system when actually it was like the life support monitoring system, which wouldn't actually do anything bad if removed. So, like, you know, the Doctor got it wrong on Arcturian engineering.
Which, I mean, fair enough. He's got a lot of stuff in his brain.
Yeah. I liked that detail that it was like, we know that this was like a frame up or whatever because of this technical detail that Isla knows because he's smart. But yeah, the planet Arcturus is poor in mineral wealth, and he'd hoped to arrange a separate mining treaty with Peladon. Yeah, I think they say that it's going to run out, like, Arcturus is going to run out of minerals in, like, 10 years or something, which is, you know, stop mining if you're going to run out. Peladon asks the delegates to help him avert a civil war with Hepesh. While they discuss the situation, Grun slips into the tunnels and attacks Hepesh to atone for having been manipulated. Hepesh's guards manage to overpower Grun and leave him for the Doctor to find, whereupon the two put aside their differences and pursue Hepesh. I love how much Grun gets to do in this story. It's good.
Yeah.
He's just kind of, you know, pathos. Whatever.
Does it count as I guess it does count as disability rep, which is something we don't actually see that much of in Doctor Who.
Yeah, you know, it's nice. He's I think in the book it's specifically his tongue got cut out, which yikes. Similar to
but Luke... also sort of fits with everything that's going on at this place.
Always makes me think of Lupus from Roman Mysteries.
That's exactly where my brain went.
An all-time character. I love Lupus. Let's start a Roman Mysteries podcast. Why not?
Look at me, our book club. Join our Patreon and join our Roman Mysteries book club.
There's fucking 18 of those books. Joe and the Ice Warriors finally convince Alpha Centauri to bend the rules and support King Peladon, but they find that all their transmitters have been sabotaged and they are cut off from their orbiting spacecraft. I love this because they're like, we need to all be in agreement, and they all put their hands up except Alpha Centauri, and like, Isley glares at Alpha Centauri until they put their hand up, and they're like, I'm registering that I was, that my decision was made under duress, or whatever. Do you like my impressions this episode? I feel like I'm getting
adoring
better.
Adoring them. You're bringing so much energy to the studio. I love it.
Yeah, we have positive energy in the studio today. The two separate studios. So Hepesh leads his followers in a revolt, quickly defeating the royal guards and capturing the king. The Doctor and Grant find Agador and hypnotise him again. The Doctor has made this like hypnotising thing, which is basically a dentist's mirror that spins on a stick. And
to me, it looks kind of like the spinning thing from Inception.
Yeah, or like a time turner. That situation. Sorry to reference Harry Potter, I'll never do it again. it's like, you know, he holds it up and sings a song. Joe got immediately hypnotized by it when he was showing her it, which I thought was very funny.
So that's, again, more hypnosis in Doctor Who.
I was going to say, we're 8 for 8 on hypnosis and mind control so far. When will this...
Is it really a show about travelling time and space, or is it a show about hypnosis?
It's very suspicious. We'll see when we finally break the streak, and it'll be a sad day. A very sad day. Yeah. Where was I? As Hepesh gives the delegates a chance to leave the planet peacefully, the Doctor leads Agador into the throne room. He explains that although they were thought extinct, Hepesh found one Agador and trained it to do his bidding. Agador attacks and kills Hepesh in a rage after being controlled for so long. Valid. We support Agador.
He had it coming.
Yeah. The Doctor, I don't know if theorizes or states is like the right term for it, but it, like training any animal, you can either do it through positive feedback or negative feedback. And Hepesh definitely was not giving Agador treats, is what I'm going to say.
Wasn't giving anybody anything positive, frankly.
He sucks. Peladon now has no problem ordering the rebels to lay down their arms. Although the TARDIS has been dragged up from the valley below, the Doctor and Joe decide to stay for Peladon's coronation. Now, my thing is, I didn't realise that Peladon hadn't already been crowned.
Me neither. I just thought he was the king. Maybe he was acting king.
They must have mentioned it at some point, like the opposite of a regent or whatever. Maybe, you know. Like, they mention at some point the time that after his father died, his mother brings him in and they sit him on the throne and they're like, now you're king. So I don't know why this doesn't count. Also earlier, the delegates informed Joe of their suspicion of the alliance that's being planned between Earth and Peladon because of her upcoming marriage to Peladon, and she goes, we're just good friends. It's very funny because Isley says it, and he seems like the character least likely to gossip, and yet here he is
doing a gossip.
He's no they didn't every day checking out what's going on. The Doctor reminisces about other coronations he has witnessed and speculates that their journey to Peladon was no accident, but a contrivance by the Time Lords to have the Doctor deal with this crisis. He didn't get the TARDIS working after all. Yeah, this is like, it's his first trip out, and the Time Lords are once again making him do things. And it's like, for God's sake.
just give him some peace. Stop being so mean.
I'm going to be honest, don't like the Time Lords.
You haven't seen The Deadly Assassin yet.
I am aware, but every other piece of information, the Five Doctors doesn't make me like the Time Lords.
Oh no, I'm not saying it's a good thing about the Time Lords.
No, I know. I understood the implication. I'm just saying that already hate them.
Yep, it's not hard.
It's not hard. Agador then wanders in to see the Doctor. Very cute. He's become rather fond of the Time Lord. He's essentially accidentally adopted Agador, and he's going to have to leave him because he can't have an Agador on the TARDIS. He's not house trained.
Yes, he can.
He's not house trained.
It's like every D&D party adopting a pet.
It really is. The Doctor leads Agador off to his enclosure as Peladon comes in to ask Joe for an answer to his proposal. She tells him that she can't marry him and that she's not really a princess. Peladon says that he never cared about her rank but accepts her decision. Clearly untrue, because if she wasn't a princess, or if she admitted she wasn't a princess,
then she would have been killed.
Hepesh would have killed her. Like,
I think Hepesh probably would have killed anyone.
Yeah. As the Doctor and Joe head to the throne room, they encounter an embarrassing visitor, Amazonia, the real Earth delegate, delayed and indignant. I love this so much.
Like, oh, it's so good.
They decide to slip away and watch some other coronation instead. As Amazonia, Sorg and Isla come into the room where the TARDIS is stored, they see it dematerialise. Amazonia is left gaping and speechless. I do like that one of the planets was going to send a female delegate, you know. Last second save, we get two female characters in the episode. They managed to dive in.
Only just.
But yeah, so that's the end of the serial.
To remain in this universe, the creature would have to reverse its polarity.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
I really liked it, yeah. I think, obviously we'll get more into it when we talk about it in depth, but it just hangs together so well. It's got these great supporting characters, good mystery, you know, good creature design. Yeah. Just a good Doctor Who serial, you know?
It's what we enjoy. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, exactly. Nothing.
I mean, aside from the murder.
Aside from the murder. But, you know, it was kind of a vaguely defined murder anyway. I feel like...
Yeah.
In a show that was allowed to show blood, Torbis would have been eviscerated. Like,
yeah.
It would have been like the fucking meat puzzle on NCIS. That's a reference.
All right, shall we... Shall we jump on into our doctor discussion?
Yes.
An apple a day keeps the No, never mind.
As we already talked about, love the Venusian lullaby. Great deal.
You know? Lovely singing.
Yeah, it is really good singing. Lovely. I did go through John Pertwee's Spotify a while ago. It's mostly comedy songs and like fairy tales, but I want there to be this Venusian lullaby. Can someone do a mix of this? I feel like
a 5-hour-long version to get me to sleep each
now
night.
Now that sea shanties are back in, I feel like this has kind of a sea shanty vibe. You could probably get it going on TikTok.
Maybe I'll try that this evening.
Yeah. We're both very good at remixes. Singing, kicking ass. What can't this doctor do?
Not be mean to Joe.
I was about to say respect.
They still
women.
Have a lovely dynamic and they're great to watch. But as you said earlier, he's quite... patronizing.
I said it and then I was about to say respect women and then I was like, sometimes he respects women. He does love Joe. Like, she is very young and he's like 500 years old. He probably views her as extremely a child, unlike all his other companions, but yeah, it's not great. No. I've noted that his distrust of the Ice Warriors is a nice bit of character continuity from 2 to 3. Like, it I feel like, as modern Classic Who fans, or at least I feel this sometimes, like, my brain, the jump from 2 to 3 is so wide. But obviously a lot of, like, everyone watching it at the time would probably remember 2. And they would want to have that continuity between the characters. That makes sense?
Yeah.
So it's nice to have references to it.
I think because most of what we have of 3 is still in colour, and most of 2 is all black and white, it feels a lot more distant.
Well, it's all in colour now.
Value and all that.
I want to tell the listeners that we solved the mystery of why Spearhead from Space and Terror of the Orsons are remembered in black and white. It's because... We didn't buy the VHS. When the BBC re-aired all of the classic Doctor Who that survived in the early 90s, my mum bought...
In like 92.
My mum bought a lot of VHS tapes and it got my gran to record them. So all of the early third Doctor ones were still in black and white. So that's why.
Incredible.
Yeah. I'm very sad that we no longer have those VHS tapes because I bet there were some great, like, idents in the BBC. I've got into watching them on the DVDs now, where it's like trailers and intros.
Nice.
It's like the BBC announcer attempting to pretend that they care about Doctor Who.
I am yet to actually watch those. I've been skipping past those.
They're
maybe
quite
I'll
fun. They're quite fun. There are too many of them because there's one for the beginning of every episode and there's one.
Yeah.
But it works, you know. It's
lots.
Fun. But yeah, so that's why Terror of the Autons I remember in black and white. Honestly, I think it might work better in black and white. But that's partly because I always found black and white scary as a child. Bill and Ben and Andy Pandy scarred me for life, obviously. Any Watch With Mother content. That's
not hard.
Yeah. Any other 90s babies who were made to watch with mothers, sound up on Twitter.
Do you have the same trauma?
Do you have the same the wooden tops trauma that I do? So good.
Ooh, that takes me back.
Yeah. Love, Agador, Time Lord's best friend.
Yes. I'm very sad we didn't get to keep Agador. Also, I would love an Agador plushie.
Yes! Oh my god.
That would be very good.
Can the Doctor Who shop get on Classic Who merch that's not, like, overly stylized or whatever?
Get us a Yeti. Get us an Agador.
Yeah. The Doctor Who pattern book. I've now made two things from it. Maybe I'll have... Like, definitely have a Yeti pattern in there somewhere. I will have to attempt it.
Yes, you will.
Because I love the Yeti, and they need to bring the Yeti back to be big, cuddly monsters.
It's a crime that the Yeti haven't been in Yu Who.
I don't care if you think that they're stupid or, like, you know, old or not scary. They don't need to be scary. The Adipose weren't scary.
They have very similar aesthetics.
Yeah, and I do own a cuddly Adipose.
Oh.
Yeah. I love his outfit for the reason that the overcoat is horrible and the actual outfit is great.
I think I would just love everything that Three wears.
Yeah, it's good. He takes off
looks like a magician trying to be a professor.
Yeah, exactly. He takes off his jacket for the fight, but not the waistcoat, and he doesn't roll up his sleeves as far as I remember. So he's got this like woolen waistcoat and, you know, his fancy trousers and his frilly shirt, and it's just incredible. It's aesthetic. Very good. And also I love him in the fight. I love him.
Yeah.
I love Action Doctor. I think
Action Doctor is very good.
And when he starts strangling Gran at the end and you're like, oh god, are they about to kill someone on Doctor Who?
And then they bring it right back.
Yeah, it's very much the end of the fight in Amok Time. which they probably had seen, because that was in, what, 1968? Something like that?
Something like that.
I should know this, but I don't. Don't expect me to know the air dates of the original series. All I know is every interaction that Kirk and Spock had off by heart. It's fine.
I am not surprised.
Yeah. So, any other thoughts on the Third Doctor, this serial?
None really to add, other than I love his singing. Can he sing me to sleep?
That's fair.
Oh, sure. Lots of people.
And there's a woman!
A woman. A woman? Hey!
Have to go.
Now look, if you're going to be in trouble, you'll need me to look after you.
Me too.
But you don't understand.
I adore Joe.
Yes.
Again, not surprising to anybody.
We could roll this into Wife City and have Wife City and Companion Drop combined.
I mean, we'll probably talk about exactly the same things in both. So yeah, let's
be
bold.
I'll try and combine the drops. We'll see how it goes. but yes, Joe, wife, best friend. Role model, idol,
adventuring friend.
Yeah, she is the
very
best.
Good.
Like, I always liked Jo, but having watched The Mutants and this, I'm like, oh, she's great. She's like, every
she's
time
so
I watch
good.
Her, she's rising the ranks of my favorite companions.
What I really love about her is, again, she was brought in because Liz Shaw was too clever, so the like, higher-ups were like, you need to bring in someone a bit dim, and they're like, well, we'll have someone who's not book smart, but she's going to be fucking clever as heck.
Yeah.
More than one way to be a competent woman.
Yeah, it does vary an episode, and I don't like the premise of it, but Katie Manning is so good. Like,
she's charming.
She's so lovely. I followed her on Twitter recently. She's great. Every day
she
she's like,
have grandma vibes.
I tried to make a little gif for you all, but it didn't quite work out.
Bless her.
Yeah, so she's great. She's great on commentaries. And then Jo herself is just this fantastic 70s, you know, go-go girl, whatever. She's like wearing platform heels and miniskirts and just running about. And you're like, oh, I love
you. I think this is probably the longest outfit she wears.
Yeah, it's a lovely outfit. Apparently they had
it's
to add,
beautiful.
Because of the outfit, they had to add in the line about going out on the town with Mike Yates. obviously in my heart they're going on a gay bar crawl, but who knows whether that's gonna work.
What I wouldn't give to join that adventure.
Yeah, what I wouldn't give to meet Jo Grant in a lesbian bar in the 1970s is what I'm saying. I could wear my one 1970s dress, because I do own a 1970s dress.
A single one.
Yes, it is a floral one that I wore to a ball. And everyone
Lovely.
Said, you're really brave for wearing that dress. And I was like, I just like it. I don't know what you want from me. It's very comfy.
Which is the most important thing.
Exactly. But yeah, just every time she stands up for herself or goes and does something because she wants to, not because someone else has been like, don't do it.
She's the one who finds the tunnel when they're climbing the cliffs.
Yeah. And three is like, where have you gone, Joe? And he thinks she's fallen off the cliff. And you're like, oh, God.
And she's like, I'm here. It's fine.
Yeah, she's like, I'm over here, Doctor. She's grinning. I like that her hair doesn't get wet in the rain.
It must be magical.
Must be magical.
That TV magic.
Yeah, she's got beautiful hair in this as well because she's curled it for the night out. It's just lovely and princessy.
Very much so.
She's just... the bit where they tell her to stay in the room and she climbs out of the window, it's just... It's such an indicative moment for Joe as a character. You could, someone ask, well, what's Joe like? And you go, well, once some ice warriors told her to stay where she was and she immediately climbed out of a window and left. And it's like, yeah, that's Joe Grant, you know?
It's brilliant and I love her. And
she's wonderful. And she's very pretty. I just want to say that for Wife City. She's beautiful, you know?
Yes. Princess Josephine of TARDIS.
Yes.
Yes, please.
Yeah, I want her outfit. I want to marry her. Please. I don't separate my leadership and my personal feelings, Joe. I'll respect you as a person.
I hope she accepts your proposal.
Thank you. Let me know, Joe, on the astral plane. I'll be like Snape Wives or whatever, but with Joe Grant, and that's infinitely superior.
That's quite the image.
Yep.
Thank you.
That's the intention. All right, next up we have...
On your knees, Doctor.
All right, gay shit in this episode. The outfits. Well, oh my
holy
god.
Holy shit. They could have jumped out of a Village People video.
The fucking outfits. Like, Peladon stands up and you go, is he wearing anything below, like... the very, very top of his thighs, because it's very short. And then he's wearing thigh-high boots / stockings.
All colour-coordinated. The colour scheme is like purple and white.
Yeah, it's like navy, purple, indigo, whatever, like velvet. And he's got like blonde hair slicked back and like, you know.
Very intense.
It's very intense and good. It's like...
very queer.
Yeah, it's... exceedingly good. And then obviously, you know, like, the Doctor's always wearing his ruffled shirts and all that, which isn't inherently gay or camp, but looking back on it now, it's pretty campy.
It's got very dandyish vibes.
It does have very dandyish vibes, as the first Doctor notes later on.
I cannot wait till we get the third Doctor and the Master in the same story.
Oh my god, yes.
My jam.
Hepish and Torbis is Peladon's two dads. Now, the TARDIS wiki claims they're brothers. If someone can, like, clip the bit where it says that, please let me know so I can stop thinking this. But, like, they were his two dads, right?
Basically.
It's like a sitcom, My Two Dads, starring Hepish, Hepish, Torbis and Peladon, who presumably has another name, but we don't hear it. Which is very feminist, actually, to have a man with no name. Sorry. It doesn't pass the Peladon test because Peladon doesn't have a name, so he can't speak to another named character.
Wow.
Gran's outfit we've already discussed. All wrestling.
Very.
All wrestling is homoerotic.
You're not wrong.
Like, all. And also Gran is like nearly naked while doing it. In the book, there's this incredible description of the armour that Gran wears, because it's all like...
oh my god,
and I'll get to it in the EU segment, but like, the entire fight is a lot more elaborate, and there's scenes setting it up that aren't in the serial, so I'll talk about those later, because they actually add context and explain where people find information. And you're like, ooh.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then the final gay thing is the Ice Warriors!
I'm just going to give you the stage.
I just think that Islia and Sorg are married. Here's my evidence. They sleep in the same bed. Islia has a sparkly cape, which is gay of him. They have so many times where they have conversations, just the two of them, which I think is quite rare for a, like, a good side character, if that makes sense. Like, obviously villain duos are off and off planning on their own, but Islia and Sorg are like... it's almost like this is an episode of the Isla and Sorg show where the Doctor and Joe are in the background. You could imagine that perspective of it, right? where show up and start investigating this thing, and then these two suspicious Earth people come up. They've got the whole thing. They're sharing their quarters. They're, like, sorting things out. And also, I imagine that in order to be able to sleep in one bed, they have to get out of those big tortoise shells and cuddle. I don't know.
Oh.
I'm not saying that there's a lot of evidence for it. I just got that vibe. You know? My gaydar pinged for Isra's
You've been talking talk. About it every day since you watched the episode.
I fucking have. I'm sure Aim is extremely annoyed with me at this point, but, you know...
Oh, no, quite the opposite. Excellent. I'm loving it.
Let's go on a train to gender.
You're one of these television chaps, then?
I am no sort of chap, sir.
Get your tickets out, because there's a ticket instructor.
There's the gender conductor is on the way.
Toot, toot.
Sorry, I did such a terrible introduction to this segment. I'm going to keep it all in.
Please do, it's beautiful. It's a work of art.
But yeah, so Alpha Centauri is technically speaking...
is waiting for us on this platform of the gender station.
Yes. Alpha Centauri is technically a non-binary character.
Mm-hmm.
We probably will get into the fact that alien characters and robot characters being non-binary is pretty much a cop-out when it comes to gender exploration in fiction. I did quickly have a Google to see what other representations of gender, like, you know, diverse situations there were in fiction at the time. I couldn't find too much, but I did find out that The Left Hand of Darkness came out, like, 5 years before. So, like...
So there's definitely precedent for it.
Yeah, there is precedent. And obviously, non-binary people and trans people have existed for all of history. So, theoretically,
we just haven't always had the same language we have for it.
Anyone in the production team could have gone to a gay club at this point in history and met someone who was gender diverse. But I do think it's not even progressive. I think it's nice that they included a non-binary alien. Like, the concept of intersex characters are so rare. I don't know that intersex alien characters are any rarer, if that
more
makes
common.
Sense. Yeah, like... it's just not something that comes up very much. And I appreciate that they put it in. What we don't appreciate is...
quite a lot of it.
Yeah. Also, I only just saw your hashtag, is it okay that? So I guess we can talk about that a bit more later, maybe. But yeah, it's...
Shall we talk about what we like about Alpha Centauri and then get into the criticism?
Here's the things that I love. Whiny non-binary, or as Alex would say, non-winery. I relate to that very much. I like that they have six arms. I think that's a fun part of the creature design. I like the cape.
I like the shade of green.
Yeah, I like the big eye. Like, it's just, it's a very fun alien design. And it's, you know, I'm trying to think of other very, like, non-humanoid aliens that have been in Doctor Who up to this point.
They're few and far between.
Yeah.
But, like, the actual Daleks inside the casing.
Yeah. Like, most
and
of...
outside the casing, honestly.
Like, most of them have two eyes, two arms, two legs, right? Like, even when you get to the Zarbi or whatever way back, it's still a man in a costume.
Yeah, wait, I mean, to an extent, that's just because it's easier to make.
Wait, is it the Monoptera? I'm thinking of the Monoptera. I can't remember what the Zarbi looked like. But the Monoptera are the butterfly people who are just guys in butterfly outfits.
I want to be in a butterfly outfit.
I haven't seen
Instead,
most of
I'm in my pyjamas.
Yeah. God, that would be nice, wouldn't it? Butterfly outfit.
As soon as I can leave the house and see people, I'll dress up as a butterfly.
It's nice to have that character design. In the behind-the-scenes bit, we'll have a great quote about the character design. We're teasing it because it's very funny. I like that the novelization does occasionally use the singular they. The singular they has been around and attested for centuries.
Yep. If anything, it's been around for longer than gendered pronouns.
I think that it just feels like it. I don't know. It's like when I found out that snails are technically hermaphroditic, right? So you could call a snail it, but no one's going to go, oh, look at that cute snail. Or well, I guess they would, but like comparing Alpha Centauri to a snail doesn't work because Alpha Centauri is a sentient adult character. Like, don't use it.
It's the sort of thing that
people.
Would be, unless they request it.
Yeah, unless they request it. But I doubt that the people who wrote this episode knew about the concept of pronouns as something that you can decide on.
Choose.
Yeah. And I'm not going to use the term preferred pronouns because they just are someone's pronouns and get used to it.
Yep. It's the sort of thing that would be less contentious if there was any other representation, but when this is all there is...
Yeah, you got to think about it. Because, you know, even in Doctor Who, they very often... Like, I think that there are other things where they don't gender things, but like, this is the first one that I've come across while we've been doing this podcast and that I can remember. So obviously in the future we'll also note it if it comes up.
But the fact that none are jumping to mind.
Yeah, I'm like, did they call the robot in robot a he? But then is the robot in robot sentient or not? I can't remember. Like, there's a lot of those kinds of things.
Again, do robots count? I think this moves on to the point that I've made about when you have so many different races in Doctor Who, is it okay that the first one I think you're really portraying as having a non-binary approach to gender is so non-humanoid? Because that automatically aliens.
I mean,
that portrayal of gender.
Here's the thing, I don't think it is okay necessarily, but I think it's cool, like I said, that the 1970s has this in a show that is like being watched by 10 million people. I think it would be better if they had, like, obviously I've been joking about 3 being the most non-binary Time Lord. The writers did not intend for 3 to be non-binary.
Like, however, that is just...
Yeah. Like, this is the first character that I know of in Doctor Who that is intentionally outside of the human conception of the gender binary. I wish that there were more things like that. Like, I think up until the new series, very recently, Ice Warriors were all male, right?
I think but so, yeah.
At no point did they explore that. Because... It's like the thing in Discworld, right? You've read Discworld, right? Please say.
Yeah.
So the thing in Discworld with the dwarves, where they all present as male until Cherry is like, hey, I'm a woman and I would like to present as a woman. Like, that's an interesting exploration of it. Whereas Doctor Who just doesn't ever explore these single gender species or the concept of having a non-binary alien. They just don't do it. And I would love if they would start doing that in the new series, but... We'll see.
We can only hope.
We can only
hope. I think it's also when you have so many episodes where you have effectively one named female character.
Yeah.
Like, if you're having sexism issues before you get to trans issues, then it's like a matrix of issues rather than a scale of issues.
Yeah, and obviously the model minority thing about any trans character, Alpha Centauri is a whiny little... so whiny, and I kind
Alpha Centauri is a friend, and I would die for them.
But here's the thing: they are very whiny and annoying. And at one point, Isla is like, "God, I wish Alpha Centauri would shut up." I kind of like, I feel like a non-binary character now has it like gets portrayed. Like, I know there's a non-binary character on Disco. They're usually portrayed as like as far as like the two that exist. They're portrayed as these like essentially the model minority myth, right? Where they're like an entirely positive character or whatever. I haven't seen the
Disco
episodes. It is
very frustrating. I think that happens a lot with just general queer representation in modern media.
Yeah.
The purity myth. If your character is queer, then they can't do anything bad. If your character is queer, then you've got to make us look good.
Exactly, which is...
Where actually we're people as well, and we fuck up and we make mistakes. Yeah. And
like, obviously,
that doesn't invalidate any of our queerness.
Yeah, queer coding villains is a homophobic practice. However, reclaiming those villains, for example, the Master... on an LGBT Doctor Who podcast, is praxis. there's a bit of a wandering conversation, but basically, Alpha Centauri good. We're not sure about how good the writing of Alpha Centauri is. And I know that they come back in Monster of Peladon, right? So I guess we'll get to talk about that again.
Yes, they do. We get more.
We'll get to talk about them again when we get to that. So look forward to that in, 3 years. I don't know. We'll find out.
All right, what's next?
Behind the scenes!
There are scenes, and we shall go behind them.
Today's science fiction so often becomes tomorrow's science fact.
The Curse of Peladon was first broadcast in January and February of 1972. The episode is what got the BBC to ban the use of firelighters in the studio, because all of the torches were using firelighters and the soot would get everywhere and nearly caused several health hazards.
God.
And afterwards the BBC were like, okay, that's too much, no more. It had the highest viewing figure since 1965. There were obviously quite a lot of parallels with joining the EU, which was the ECC at the time.
Yep.
I think was it Harold Wilson who was Prime Minister when this happened?
It was Wilson or Heath? Hang on, it was
who?
Oh my God, it was Heath.
Nice.
It was the miner strike.
Very good.
It was the miner strike in 72, which was in January and February. Yes. Oh my God, that was a Tory government, for the record. Fuck the Tories.
fuck the Tories.
Sorry, I have to say it.
It is the official view of this podcast.
Yes.
So there is a little clip that they show in a small documentary about parallels with the miners' strikes in the EU, where a political leader is saying, this is a decision that won't happen again for a very long time, if ever.
Oh.
Which I wish we lived in that timeline. Yeah. So it brings up the sort of discussion of how many of Curse of Peladon's themes were inspired by contemporary events.
So many.
So little bit of a history drop. So the story is an allegory of the UK's ascension to the common market, which was highly topical, as we've mentioned. The UK had applied to join the EU twice before this, but had been vetoed by the Anglophobic Charles de Gaulle, the President of France.
Sorry, I love that concept. Just the French guy going there like, no, fuck the English.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened, because you needed to have a unanimous vote, and it was just Charles de Gaulle being like, no, I do not like them.
Charles de Gaulle Charles de Gaulle is the Alpha Centauri /Arcturus of the EEC, obviously.
But he resigned or was voted out in 69.
He was the president during World War II, wasn't he, of France?
That might be why his name sounds so familiar. Yeah. So he'd been around for a while. The UK applied to join again for a third time and was accepted in 1972, and a referendum was held in 1975 to ratify this result. Pretty much all of the arguments against joining the EU were exactly the same rhetoric as the Leave campaign was using in the 2016 referendum.
Who would have guessed that xenophobia is always the same?
Very much the more things change, the more things stay the same. There's a lot more to learn about how the ECC, later the EU, works.
European Economic Commission.
So highly recommend doing a little bit of reading into that if you're interested.
It's interesting.
It's fascinating. It's also very much like a rabbit warren of information. So Terence Dix was still the showrunner or producer at this stage. He didn't notice this at the time because he didn't relate these stories to things like outside politics. If that's not privilege, I don't know what is.
He would not know an allegory if it bit him on the arse, honestly.
Yeah.
Sorry to anyone who's a big Terence Dix fan. We just don't like him. Just not
a fan. I mean, I don't like him because of the things he says, which is a fair reason.
Yeah, certainly. I also don't like him because of the things he says.
So the director for this episode, to move on from Europe, was a guy called Lenny Mayne, who is an ex-dancer. Yay. And used to just like dance around the studio and bring a lot of energy to it. Alpha Centauri was originally supposed to change colour to reflect their mood. Yep. The fact that this didn't happen is homophobia in action.
It's in the book!
It's in the book! Yes! I'm so glad. During rehearsals, Lenny Mayne, the director, was appalled to discover what the costume department had constructed for Alpha Centauri, which he believed to be unambiguously phallic. To compensate, costume designer Barbara Lane outfitted the hexapod with a yellow cloak. Upon seeing the costume for the first time, Mayne said, "It looks like a fucking prick." When the cloak was added, he said, "Now it looks like a prick in a cape."
It doesn't look so bad on camera because most of the time it's filmed like from the waist up.
Yeah.
So slightly less phallic. But when you see the whole thing with the
it's very phallic.
With the like the skirt at the feet to hide the actor's feast.
Yep. It's certainly a choice.
Yeah.
Cool. And we've already mentioned that King Peladon's played by Patrick Troughton's first son, David Troughton.
Yay. Is that from his initial family or his secret family? God.
He has a secret family.
I'm sure we'll get into Patrick Troughton's infidelities at some future point, but yes.
Okay.
Harry Melling, his grandson, his side of the family did not talk to Patrick Troughton because of the secret family situation. God.
Oh.
I keep finding this out every time I look at his Wikipedia page and I rediscover this fact. And I'm like, oh, right, yeah.
Well, I will read into that.
Yeah, feel free. Right, now let's go to...
We'll all go, except Miss Shaw.
Oh, just a minute. I'm not going to miss all
the... No, Miss Shaw.
Have you never heard of female emancipation?
Liz, this time I think he's right.
Yeah.
It's a one-woman serial once again until the last 2 minutes. One woman in the whole thing.
Does it really count?
It really doesn't. They could have made
anyone
a woman. And I know they're like, oh, well, Peladon's an old-fashioned misogynist society. Just make it a matriarchy. Why not? Why not have them all be women?
And then we would also get Joe/Queen Peladon.
Yeah.
Which we deserve, honestly.
I've already rewritten the mutants to be lesbians. Maybe I should rewrite this to be lesbians.
Is this going to be your new hobby?
Yeah. My new hobby is that I write this and then I send it to AIM and never post it anywhere.
And I remember it exists every now and then, read it and enjoy it.
Yay.
It's a good way to live.
I just want to discuss the EU metaphor. Which member of the EU is the Ice Warriors? I must know.
Ooh.
Because I feel like the obvious and perhaps a little fraught answer would be Germany. But let's go deeper. Like,
I wonder if you have any deeper theories about this. Let's see who is.
Let's go on Gallifrey face. You do that and I'll do this and we'll find out.
All right, so members at the time of this airing, we had Belgium, France, Germany/West Germany, Italy, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands.
And since Peladon is a metaphor for England.
Yep. Or the UK.
Maybe the Ice Warriors are a metaphor for France.
Because they're like, maybe not you.
Because in the past, France and England have been at war a lot. But now they That's have true. To be nice to each other. And then Alpha
I have nothing
Centauri,
to add.
Like, I don't know.
Luxembourg?
Oh yeah, that would be good.
It fits.
Arcturus is like...
Belgium.
Yeah, or like post-Brexit Britain.
You mean an absolute clusterfuck?
Yeah! God.
Sorry
for mentioning the word Brexit. I've brought the tone down. It does remind me of once when I was when I was teaching some year fours and they had to include their spelling words in a sentence. One of the words was confusion. Someone had written on their whiteboard, "The confusion of Brexit is overwhelming."
They're not wrong.
Yeah, and then I've just written a point about isolationism versus internationalism. Basically, I think that's the conflict in the episode is like isolationist Hepesh versus internationalist Torbis and Peladon. And then Arcturus is taking advantage of that isolationism in an attempt to exploit Peladon's natural resources. So it's quite political in its own way. I guess Arcturus is like pro-fracking.
I think this is something that they delve into a lot more in The Monster of Peladon.
Ooh, then we'll get to it in several years. Not much to critique, honestly. I really liked it.
Yeah, maybe it's just because I'm very sleepy at the moment. Mostly, I just really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was a good one.
I like enjoying things.
Yeah, it's so nice, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah, so now we're getting in the TARDIS and hopping the timelines to the expanded universe.
Let me get this straight. A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard, it can move anywhere in time and space?
Yes.
Quite so.
But that's ridiculous.
Start off by discussing the novelization, which was... Nice. It was good. As I've mentioned, it had some extra stuff in it. At one point, the Doctor has a bit of internal monologue where he's wondering if Hepesh is sincere in his convictions, because he thinks, patriotism was often a genuine motive in driving men to commit the most violent acts to preserve their nation's freedom. If this was the case with Hepesh, he might have a point, though it still didn't make his methods anything but wrong. This...
True.
This one, I'm like, is this about the IRA? Like... I don't know. I just thought that was an interesting thing to make a point of in a Doctor Who novelisation that would be read by children.
Then again, looking at a lot of children's literature, not surprising.
Yeah, and then we get a scene that has clearly been cut from the serial or they didn't have the money for, where Jo goes to look at Grun's armour for the fight, and then she attempts to persuade Grun not to kill the Doctor, basically.
Good.
She's like, well, if you kill the Doctor, then I won't be able to marry Peladon, and I know you're really loyal to Peladon, and it would only improve Peladon's standing to be married to an Earth princess. Like, it's very political of her in its own way. And presumably Arcturus was eavesdropping on this, which is how the Council knew about her engagement, theoretically.
Okay.
Like, the proposal.
That makes sense.
And then Peladon tells Agador that he wants the Doctor to win the fight and dismisses Hepesh when he tries to contradict him. Like, Peladon is sat in his throne room and is basically talking out loud to himself. And I don't remember that from the episode, so there we are.
No, it wasn't there, I don't think.
Then there's quite a long description of the pit, the fighting pit. She had half expected an arena rather like a Roman amphitheatre, flat sandy with steep walls and a cage-like entrance, which is what we got in the episode. Mm-hmm. The pit was very different. The entrance was covered by a heavily spiked portcullis. The floor was of highly polished granite, so smooth that it reflected like a lake of still water. There were only three small areas in which direct combat could easily take place. All the rest of the ground space was filled with steps, mounds, steep slopes, and a jumbled medley of pillars and short columns of stone. On the walls, on the pillars, and scattered here and there about the pit were a variety of weapons. A four-edged axe, a sword with a broad blade that became a vicious prong, a lance with a barbed three-forked head, and a triple ball and chain, hideously spiked. She shuddered and was about to turn away when the portcullis slowly opened, and into that strange arena stepped Grun and the Doctor.
Very intimidating.
Yeah, it's very dramatic. And then there's the bit where the Doctor talks about how animals can be trained with kindness, conditioning by a system of rewards, and cruelty. And the last ones are most likely from Hepesh, because he fucking sucks. And the Doctor suspects that Agador is a highly intelligent animal who would respond willingly to gentle persuasion given the chance. It's like, yeah, Agador's a good boy.
He's a very good boy.
And then Islia explaining that Peladon is rich in mineral deposits, that all that stuff. The planet of Arcturus is within 10 years of running out of its own natural resources. That's why Arcturus had to make sure Peladon didn't become part of the Galactic Federation. There's no S's, so I can't hiss. Like, there's a bit that I always think of in the Seeds of Death, where one of the Ice Warriors says, "Genius." And that's where my Ice Warrior impression comes from. It's just that one word. But yeah, basically they're condemning the material exploitation of non-developed cultures. Very woke of Doctor Who, I think.
Yeah.
There's another
good place for it to go.
Yeah, there's another cutscene where Grun pledges fealty to the Doctor as a master of Agador. And the Doctor says, fuck that, and like pulls him to his feet and shakes his hand as like an equal. It's nice. Hepesh calls Peladon my son when he's dying. I have the thing about Alpha Centauri changing colours like a chameleon. And as we've already mentioned, they removed the line about Alpha Centauri being an it rather than a he, and then just used a bunch of different pronouns.
Fair. It's something.
I looked up what Peladon has done in the EU, like what's been set on Peladon. I discovered that there's a mention of Islia, but other than that, there is no more Islia and Sorg in the expanded universe. I want more of it.
Hey, Big Finish, commissioners to write.
Big Finish! We're going to write an Islia and Sorg detective thing. If you
detective
can make,
series.
If you can make Jago and Lightfoot, you can make Islia and Sorg. yeah, so there's a companion chronicle, The Prisoner of Peladon, which is the first and possibly only companion chronicle to be written from the perspective of someone who wasn't a companion, because it's from King Peladon's perspective.
Okay.
Then there's the main range audio, The Bride of Peladon, which is Eremem's exit story, and has a pregnant Agador.
Baby Agador! Wait, if it's the only one left, how did it get pregnant?
I think there might be two babies. I don't know. I can't remember if it's before or after, because apparently the visits that the Doctor makes to Peladon happen 50 years apart each time. And who knows? Maybe it's like, oh shit, I used to know the word. You know, spontaneous pregnancy. What's the fucking
combustion
word? Not an immaculate
conception.
Not even an immaculate... parthenogenesis! It is, you know, Immaculate Conception, but parthenogenesis. Yeah. And then there was also a Virgin New Adventure novel, Legacy, which was originally a fan audio script for a series of the audio visuals, which was never produced. But they novelized it for the Virgin New Adventures. And it features Peladon leaving the Federation to avoid getting exterminated by Daleks, because in the meantime, the Galactic Federation has become... I can't remember what it's called, but in the Dalek Master Plan, Mavic Chen is the leader of this organization, and that's what the Galactic Federation turns into, and then he allies with the Daleks and then gets everyone exterminated. So Peladon Prexits. Like, you know.
I mean, that's a much better reason than we have.
Yeah, it is a much better reason than we have. So that's the presence of Peladon in the EU. I've already talked about Three and Joe's presence in The Mutants, so obviously go back to that if you want more info on that. I did want to mention the existence of Iris Wildtime, which is Katie Manning's other main appearance in Big Finish. Iris Wildtime is a dirty old time lady with a double-decker time bus. She's kind of like her own entity. She has crossed over with the Doctor a couple of times, but mostly she's off having drunk adventures and being a lesbian in various incarnations.
Yes, okay. I didn't actually know I needed this until right this now.
There is,
right this moment.
Like, I haven't really got into Iris yet, so I don't want to, like, speak on her without, you know, listening to her audios or reading her books, but there's definitely at least one thing called the Time Cock that shows up. Which
Excuse
is a,
me?
It is in fact a sex aid that shows up that's like a sonic screwdriver, I guess, but a vibrator, I think.
Oh my.
There was a post about it on Tumblr, so obviously I checked, and it is real. At least within
of course it is, okay.
It. But I don't want to speak on its purpose without doing more research. So yeah, look up RS World Time. There's a lot of audios, there's books. Yeah, and she turns up in some of the short trips, I think, which leads us well into the short trip of the episode. So,
yay,
we're taking a short trip all the way to the Brigadier's house, where he is having a party. I'm assuming it's the Brigadier's house. He's having a party and he's invited all of his old unit friends. So Joe's there and Mike Yates is there and Benton's there. But we don't see them really because this story is told from the perspective of Joe's little daughter, who's five.
Aww.
It's called Once Upon a Time Machine by Stephen Dunn. And it is about Joe's daughter asking her for a story before bed. And Joe, like, looks at all this pile of picture books, hopefully, and the kid is like, no. She's called Lisa, I'm pretty sure. Yeah. I don't have it up in front of me, so this is all from memory. but she asks Joe for a story, and Joe, slightly reluctantly, starts telling a story about her and the doctor when they went to a planet and found out that let me start the sentence again. They go to a planet and meet the princess of the planet, who is a raging bitch. And then they also meet someone called Alice, who turns out to be the fraternal twin sister of the princess. There is quite a funny line where the little girl is like, don't all twins look the same? which I thought was quite
cute.
Do
they?
Well, not all of them. Because she doesn't know about fraternal twins, just identical twins.
Yeah, of course.
But Joe goes on with the story, and they find out that the two princesses have been set all of these tasks they have to complete in order for one of them to be crowned queen, because it's like a meritocracy.
Wow, okay.
You know, which is quite fun. But the thing is that the princess who is evil has been cheating on all of them, and then accusing her sister of cheating, and has locked her away. And she's only allowed out to do all these tests. One of the tests is, you know, the princess and the pea. Like, it's basically fairy tale tests, right? And then this new test, the final test to determine who is going to become queen, is that before his death, their father or grandfather has locked these three items in a vault, which neither of them can get into.
Okay.
And they have to, through magical powers, divine what is inside the box. And obviously the princess sister, who's evil, has like burrowed into the back of the vault and looked to see what's inside. And she saw like a chalice, a crown, and a scepter. And then, you know, basically the other sister is like, well, obviously I've got no hope of guessing because I'm not going to cheat. And then the doctor says, well, name three items. and she gives him three as like an umbrella and I don't know. It's a good story. Read it to find out. And a bag of gold coins to hand out to the people. Whereas the doctor's like, oh, nice. Fine, I guess I'll go find some gold coins. And then the next morning they have this test and they're asked what's inside the box. And the evil sister says the three things that she saw. And then the other sister says the three things that she told the doctor. And then they open the vault and surprise, surprise, it's the three things that the nice sister said. Because the doctor went back in time and put them in there, which I think is quite charming.
Cute.
And then she becomes queen and it's all nice. And it's just so cute.
That sounds like, lovely.
I really recommend it. It's in... Oh, which one is it in? I'm gonna very quickly check which one it's in, because otherwise I will never remember.
There are quite a lot of them now.
There are so many of them. I have all of them. I've got the Decalogues. I've got these. Indefinable Magic, I believe, is the collection. It's the last...
That's a lovely title for a collection.
Yeah, the last new collection of short trips by Big Finish before they did the recollections thing and lost the license. Because the BBC wanted to start publishing like their own books again, so they took the Doctor Who publishing license away from Big Finish.
Sad.
I won't let them reprint them, so they end up going for like
double sad.
They end up going for like £80 on eBay, which is why PDFs are moral. Actually,
I guess this is also. I won't go on a publishing nerd tangent. I could.
You could.
But I won't.
You could. But yeah, so that's very good. As always, I recommend reading it. As for the novelization, I recommend reading the extra scenes and maybe the fight. Otherwise, it's pretty much just the serial. And honestly, the serial is really good, so you may as well watch it. That's my expanded universe segment.
Thank you. My universe feels slightly larger.
Yay!
Let's do some rankings.
Yes, so X of the week. All right, my one is trope of the week for And There Was Only One Bed.
There was only one bed.
There's also some good, you know, like mistaken for the villain or whatever, but And There Was Only
One Bed. Fake princess.
Yeah, fake princess. It's all good. It's all good.
I think mine is going to be Lullaby of the Week with the Doctor singing Lullaby because I genuinely adore it.
Yeah, it's so nice. And it's just so calming. Even when Agador is like growling in the background, I'm like, oh, jump out, we keep singing. So yeah.
Maybe, I wonder if only there was a musical episode of Doctor Who.
If only. I mean, there's Doctor Who and the Pirates, but it's not quite the same.
It's not quite the same.
But yeah, so 6 Degrees of Blake 7. Every week I'm like, I want to hum the tune that I use for this, and then I forget the goddamn tune. It's part of the theme. But yeah, so 6 Degrees of Blake 7. I have one that I found several weeks ago and one that I realised like 2 days ago. So we've got a 2 degrees and a 1 degree. So our 2 degrees is David Troughton was in one episode of Survivors, which was a really bleak, like post-apocalyptic TV series that Terry Nation created in the 70s.
That's just his wheelhouse. Friend of the show, Terry Nation is.
It's like when Kit Pedler started Doomwatch. Like, the only thing anyone knows about Doomwatch is that there's an episode where people nearly get killed by rats, and like, the only thing I know about Survivors is that it's really depressing. So. What can I say? But yeah, so that was created by Terry Nation, who also created Blake 7, which is a really depressing and bleak sci-fi dystopia. Like, gotta get back to it. I was drying my hair yesterday. I looked in the mirror. I thought, I look like Kerr Avon. And then I was like, that's not a good look, because no one in Blake 7 has a good haircut.
Oh, wow.
Nobody. Except for when Colin Baker was on it, as mentioned. The one degree of separation is that Stuart Fell, who was the stunt coordinator... and the guy who was wearing the Alpha Centauri costume was the stunt coordinator on Blake 7. So we get some crew connections this time.
Nice. Very good. I've also got a contribution for this segment for the first time ever.
Ooh.
So in the original plans for Blake 7, at the end of the second or third season, the Daleks were meant to appear. And it was meant to be happening in the same universe as Doctor Who. But they couldn't get the rights. For some rights-based reasons. So in this episode, when they're talking about the Galactic Federation, it was intended to start that tie-in slash crossover.
Oh my god.
There you go.
That's so weird, because Terry Nation has the rights to the Daleks.
I think this is when it was co-owned by the BBC rather than the Nation Estate.
I guess. He has, but he always had to let them use the Daleks, like he always had to give permission for it.
Maybe the producers were so pissed off at always needing permission. Yeah. They're like, well,
although
we won't
to
give
be
a key
fair
for this
by
one.
season 3 of Blake 7, I think Terry Nation had left major production, so but that would have been incredible.
I know that was the intention.
That would have been so good. Oh my god,
there you go. I bet you'd never thought I'd contribute to 6 degrees of Blake 7.
I'm so excited. Now you've got to start watching it.
Maybe when the world is less awful. Maybe. Don't think I can take any more bleak media right now.
Maybe. But yeah, how about our out of five?
Out of five, I think I'd probably give this 4 purple satin short shorts out of 5.
Yeah, I think I'd give it 4 Agadors out of 5.
Nice. Very cuddly.
It's a good one. All right, overall ranking. Let's have a look. I'll check the Doctor Who magazine ranking as well.
Okay.
That's what we're doing now.
I would suggest that this goes in between the film of the novel of the film and The Keeper of Draken.
That sounds about right to me.
About in the middle for...
Yeah. I think it was very good, but it doesn't have enough... Like, the distinct things about it, like the Ice Warriors and stuff. I think that other serials above also have, like, more distinct things. Yeah, I think so. That makes it number 4 overall for us. Let's have a look at the ranking. Where do we think it's going to come out of the 200 stories that they ranked?
I'm going to guess about 110.
I'm going to guess 80. 82?
Good job.
Woo!
Very good.
It is above the Unicorn and the Wasp and below Warrior's Gate. So there you go.
Oh, interesting.
So yeah, that is 82 out of 200. And for us, it is fourth out of the 8 we've done so far.
These rankings will get more cohesive as time yes. goes by.
Hopefully. But yeah, would you like to do the outro, eh?
I'd love to do the outro. Please join us again next time when we're going to be talking about Destiny of the Daleks.
Woo!
Our first Dalek serial and also yeah. our second regeneration scene.
Very exciting.
Make sure to subscribe to us, give us a rating and review on iTunes. Tell your friends about it. Tell your pets about us.
Yep.
Tweet us at PolarityPod on Twitter or follow us at PolarityPod.tumblr.com. on Tumblr for all sorts of nonsense.
Yes.
And yeah, please, look after yourselves. Have a good week.
Yeah, please send us your ex of the week.
Yeah, please do.